be an amazing trisector athlete, and celebrate your failures.
We are Harvard Ventures, and this is The Bottom Line, a podcast about entrepreneurship, innovation, and everything in between. I'm David, and today I'll be joined by Alex and Shefali in a conversation with Chris Romer, co-founder and CEO of Project Canary. Chris founded Project Canary in 2019 as a SaaS climate data analytics company focusing on accurate corporate ESG data for emission-intensive industries. Prior to Project Canary, Mr. Romer worked on multiple higher education startups, and before that, he was a four-year Colorado state senator. His career started in finance, where his first 25 years after undergrad were as a municipal finance consultant specializing in finance for universities, colleges, cities, and state governments, working to fund student loans and provide affordable housing. Chris holds a BA in economics from Stanford, where he graduated with distinction. Today's conversation is sponsored by Seasons. Seasons, SZNS, is an NFT fractionalization and DAO platform on which anyone can create collections of NFTs for fractional ownership and collective governing as a DAO. Artists and curators can allow for democratic access to their NFTs, and collectors can begin to own high-value NFTs they could not otherwise afford. Now, let's get to The Bottom Line.
All right, so let's just dive right in. What was your time like at that, you know, that other school on the other coast? What did athletics teach you about leadership that's been applicable to your career?
I think it wasn't just athletics. It was being captain. And both in high school, I was coach and captain. And during part of my college career, which was club, so let's be clear, I was coach and captain. So I was a lacrosse player, so at a different level. And, you know, half of the team was interested in winning. The other half of the team was just interested in the beer and the kegger after the game. And so my job as captain and coach was often to let the two sides of that team have joy together and have empathy for each other and basically respect each other, that some of them really wanted to win the game. And it was important for the keggers to respect that some people wanted to win. And some of the intense winners needed to understand that some people were just showing up for the beer. And so sometimes in leader in a startup, some people are there for the exit and some people just want to solve the problem. And sometimes you have to, in leadership, teach them to understand each other. And when you learn to understand your partner or your other half of the company, then all of a sudden it becomes a much better team.
Makes perfect sense. You know, I actually used to play lacrosse and I miss the sport. And I totally understand the perspective you're talking about. Moving on, what compelled you to serve your home state as state senator after so much time in the private sector?
So 25 years on Wall Street, then I got elected to the state Senate. You know, my family's been in Democratic politics for quite a long time. And, you know, look, it was a joy. I wanted to solve problems. It's a consistent theme. In many ways, I had done about probably 7 to 10 charter schools and had a real passion for fixing K-12 education at the time. And I thought if I was a state senator, I could fix that. So I did a lot of work in workforce development, K-12, but I did a lot of work in energy early on. And look, I think it was a great time. We got a lot done. Unfortunately, if you look at Wikipedia, I'm most known for writing probably the very first iconic medical marijuana bill. So you never know what you're gonna end up doing in the state Senate. I think I would coach you all, the three of you, as well as all the people listening, to be trisector athletes. And what do I mean? If you're really going to play at the A game in life, you got to be able to go into the for-profit world, the not-for-profit world, and the government world. And that was my 4 years. Right after that, I was going to stay in politics, but the voters asked me to become an entrepreneur.
I mean, I think that's a really cool way of like kind of approaching life.
It's really important to think through the sequencing of those trisector athletes of how you move from for-profit, not-for-profit, and back into government. Because I see too many people addicted in one of them, and then they don't have the discipline to become truly a trisector athlete early enough in life. And I don't care if you want to be a U.S. senator or a CEO, you need, in my humble opinion, to check all three boxes relatively early in your careers. And so I'll just add that as a little bit more coaching to all of you trisector athletes out there.
Right. Absolutely. Thank you. Kind of switching to something you mentioned a little while ago, you mentioned you had kind of a 25-year career like on Wall Street. So we were just kind of curious how your 25 years with JP Morgan shaped your view on kind of the role that financing plays in helping projects like get off the ground.
Yes, it was five different firms. JP Morgan was just the last, so about 5 years per firm, including Royal Bank of Canada and Citigroup and some others that have gone away. So I think, look, learning how markets work, because I am a Democrat for fracking, and yet I'm really for climate change. And why do those make sense? Because I actually think it's going to be the markets that are going to solve climate change. And so being on Wall Street early in my life, right out of college, I really learned how to make the numbers work and learned to not let numbers and hypothesis bullshit you, to be candid. So, and I, not every deal was perfect, but having done about $10 billion of infrastructure, including the new airport in Denver, I learned how to bring something from fruition to basically completion. And I learned to let the numbers speak for themselves. There are too many people, particularly in government, who don't pay enough attention to budgets and numbers. And it really matters. And so there is a discipline. I started on an old mainframe teletype. I didn't get computers until about 4 years into my Wall Street career. So that dates me a little bit. Look, I know Wall Street has fallen in the choices for people. And I know startups is the big new thing. I think the three places you can learn a lot in life, one is campaigns. The amazing thing about political campaigns is you get a lot more responsibility as a young person than you're ever going to get anywhere else. So put that on the list. Wall Street, if you get the right mentor and the right boss, because the great thing about Wall Street is just a clear contract. It's just about the money and the numbers, and that's pretty clear. But the last is startups. And I would really highly argue that people ought to go have a startup experience. I just think in startups, you can get stuck below people who don't know what they're doing. And I think one of, regardless of those three choices, the question is, what's in your toolbox at the beginning of what you do? And how are you sharpening your toolbox while you're in that position? That's what I sharpened in 25 years on Wall Street is understanding the intersection of government, money, and projects.
Wow, fascinating. I think that's super interesting. That whole like wide variety of experiences and kind of like shaping your perspective on the markets to taking quantitative approach to startups. Kind of pivoting a little bit, what does your typical day look like now? And are you still involved with any of your like past projects like Guild Education?
For clarity, I'm probably the only CEO, tech CEO, that's now done $100 million Series B that was trained to be a CEO in a startup by his oldest daughter. And the story behind that is my daughter was the one who did Guild Education as CEO, and I was her co-founder, employee number three in Guild. And so that's my previous company. It's a two-sided opportunity platform in higher education for the 60 million Americans who have some college but no degree and need skills. And so that's the previous world that I did it. I'm fairly active just in advising them episodically on issues, particularly about the opportunity side for disadvantaged students, going back to low-income students, same as I did when my state Senate days. And so that's just what I did. But the good news in Guild is, and it's a true story for all those entrepreneurs out there, is that Rachel and I failed at another company called American Honors, which was a community college human capital play to get the best and brightest in community colleges to candidly transfer to people like Harvard. Go see how many community college students transfer to Harvard, and you'll see the problem I'm talking about. And so the good news is American Honors was a disastrous failure, but everything we learned from American Honors failure then became the foundation for Guild success. And the first decision is that Rachel was going to be the boss and I was going to work for Rachel.
Wow, I think that's so cool. I didn't know that your daughter played such a huge role in like your position now as like CEO of Project Canary. Kind of like pivoting a little bit more of a technical question. What do you see as the key differentiator in the emissions accounting space, which has like recently become quite saturated in recent years? And what did you intend Project Canary's like comparative advantage to be at the start, and has that changed?
So I think the best entrepreneurs are not ones who go into business to get an exit, get a multiple, or get something in TechCrunch or one of these places. I think the best entrepreneurs really, really want to solve a problem. So why we started Project Canary was actually to bend the arc of climate change using markets and getting methane, because methane is 86 times more potent than carbon dioxide. Good news for the planet, it leaves the atmosphere in 10 years, not 100 years, the way carbon dioxide goes away. So we started Project Canary to solve the problem of stopping the methane leaks and basically buying ourselves the decade for deep decarbonization. Because of the passion to do that, and because I learned at Guild how to build a startup to be a B Corp, those were really big things. And three, when I started with a scientist, I knew to make it a SaaS model, which is much more financeable than a hardware company with just a sales multiple. So those were a bunch of lessons I learned. And how do I spend my day? The problem with entrepreneurs is that there's no end to our work days. I mean, I'm still at 62, probably doing 70 hours a week. And you gotta have a lot of passion to solve the problem. You also gotta have a lot of humility that it's okay to fail, because the best entrepreneurs in the early days fly fearless. Because the moment you start pulling in and getting rid of solving the problem and flying fearless and never taking no for an answer, no is just the start of every conversation. And I get it all the time. And about half the time I convert it to yes. And those are the skills that make for good entrepreneurs. And they're all skills you can learn. Everybody can be a good entrepreneur. You just have to learn the basics of not taking no for an answer, being humble but confident, which is really complicated, because those are two very different things. You have to get out of this Facebook world where I'm afraid to fail. Like every time you screw up, put it out on a Facebook page, Twitter, hey, I screwed up today, because it'll teach you that it's okay to fail. And one of the biggest parts of your generation's problem is afraid to fail. Because of this social media where nothing is wrong in life, no, we all make tons of mistakes every day. Put every mistake you make on Facebook and be proud. Hey, look at the mistake I made today. That will change you and turn you into a good entrepreneur. Fear of failure is the biggest problem most people have.
I think that is as prevalent of a problem on our campus as it is on any group of individuals across the world.
Because you guys have never failed. For God's sakes, you got into the Stanford of the East. For God's sake, how in the world, if you got into the Stanford of the East, you can't fail. There's no way failure is part of your lives. No, practice it. Go fail.
Exactly, exactly.
Go trip. Hit the bound. Come up with road scars. Say, wow, that hurt. I just lost for the mayor. I was supposed to win the mayor's race. I lost. Ow. Best teaching in my whole life.
Yeah, everybody on campus needs to hear this episode. But yeah, we've seen that a lot of these companies are making the commitments to net zero, you know, over the next 10 years, I'm going to go carbon neutral, et cetera. And so that makes sense for how you're deriving your demand for your quantification of emissions. But I know Project Canary also works on fresh water use and community impact. How does that work? How do you drive demand generation for those areas?
So look, Europe is leading this conversation and the Ukrainian war has doubled down. We had two externalities. One externality went away. So long ago, I did push my Chrysler station wagon up that drive, that Palm Drive at Stanford, because it ran out of gas during one of the energy crises. So once upon a time, we had this externality of the bad people in the planet had all the hydrocarbons. The good news is unconventional fracking allowed us to have the externality of energy security de-risked. Thank good it did, because that was an externality that was a big part of my lifetime in the two oil shocks. Go read about them. They're real and they happened. And they did cause a lot of inflation. But the second externality is the price of carbon. We just have a failure in the public square. All of your economics professors will teach you that if you have an externality where people can cheat and make more money by cheating, that's what they will do. And so you have to bring the price of carbon into the equation. That's what we're doing. It's making so you can't be a cheater. And the way to stop to be a cheater is we put up IoT devices. And when we cheat, you're going to get called out, even though the company's on the data. So think about solving the problem is, what was the market failure? In Guild, it was higher education was failing the lowest quartile in America. They were getting some college and college degrees that weren't giving them skills. In Project Canary, the failure was we need affordable energy, but we need the price of carbon pulled in. We're going into what's called the measurement economy because net zero is a math problem. We got to measure the amount of what we got. Methane is 86 times worse than CO2. So we got to measure everything. And then we have to net it to net zero with ways to pull both carbon and methane out of the atmosphere. So when you think about it, the thing that we're doing, and this is another cool concept for entrepreneurs, we're doing what's called building the category and building the category king at the same time. That's really complicated because half of what I do is run this political movement called Project Canary. The other half of my time is building the company Project Canary. That's complicated. If you get a chance to build a startup like this, it's really fun because you get to build the category and then become hopefully one of the category players, maybe the category king or queen, by virtue of building the category and the company at the same time.
Yeah, I agree that the market is going to have to drive companies to reduce their emissions. But in general, do you think more emissions reduction from this market pressure comes from public regulation forcing it or from public pressure?
It's going to be ultimately, it's going to be your generation is going to cancel a brand. So at some point, you're going to go into your grocery store, you're going to look Chobani, Yoplait, Danone yogurt. You're going to look there and there'll be a Canary score on those three yogurt packages. An authentic ESG climate-based score will be on each one of those packages. And you'll probably choose your yogurt based upon which one is authentically the best for the climate and has met your brand expectations. So at some point, it's the buy side of the market will dictate this. And this is what a lot of big companies are afraid of, because your generation is literally going to cancel the brands that don't choose to get on the right side of climate change. We're just the data providers. We're just going to provide that scoring system. So anybody can plug authentically into trusted, independent, non-negotiable, auditable, Pricewaterhouse confirmed score. And then you can choose to put that score on your branding package or not. And so are we yet going to score prices and canary scores at gasoline stations? Not yet. But I guarantee you, read yesterday's press on the French coming back in to buy canary scored LNG. Right now in the energy markets, we've from scratch create this thing called response resource gas. Didn't exist 2 years ago. We coined the phrase and we built the category. And now Engie just came back into the US, first time after 2 years, saying they weren't gonna buy American gas, and they're buying it because of the authenticity of our scores. So I think the pressure is gonna come from the buy side. Regulators will follow the buyers. I mean, that'll be important. There'll be a regulatory minimum, but there'll be premium brands based on climate change. As your generation really understands which of these companies did right and did wrong, you're going to divest the stocks that you didn't like because they're not being authentic in their environmental assessments and scoring.
In that same vein, with like heavy pressure already on the energy revolution and a lot of these energy companies, you know, having a conflict of interest, as you mentioned, and potentially being reluctant to this sort of change, do you think we're fully ready yet? And do you have an optimistic or a pessimistic view for the timeline?
Optimistic, mostly on the buy side, because I have great belief in your generation that you're ultimately going to solve this. We have the tools to do this. I actually think the oil and gas industry, when they realize they could make more money by solving climate change than by delaying the problem. That's the tipping point. And my job is to write an economic math problem that has the ROI the highest based on solving climate change. That's what we're doing with Canary, is we're showing them, with whether it's carbon sequestration or whether it's response resource gas, we're teaching this group. And I'm, you know, I get it. There's a lot of groupthink, a lot of people who, particularly in the oil and gas industry, see environmental assessments and scoring as an anathema, because it's just been a negative, a cost driver. Now that there are actually people like NG, like Xcel Energy and Colorado Utility, who are now willing to pay a premium for really high quality green molecules, that's how you solve a problem. And look, a lot of what I do is change management. And I think this is true for a lot of entrepreneurs who are building a category. And when I went to Houston 2 years ago, about 80% of the community was in denial, 20%, 10% were kind of in bargaining, and 10% were in leadership. Those numbers have almost completely flipped in 2 years. There are still about 10% of Houston in denial. there's probably a bigger than 10%, 20 to 30%, which are in bargaining. You're like, okay, damn it, I have to do something about ESG. What's the minimum I can do? But about 50% of the executives in Houston are now trying to figure out how they're going to make the highest ROI on their shareholders by virtue of solving climate change. And that's why I'm an optimist.
So when you, I don't really know how to follow up with that. I have something to say, but I don't know how to word it. I mean, it obviously, you know, Texas had some issues last winter with freezes, and a lot of people, you're right, did pick up ESG concerns as a result of power failing in small cities. And like Dallas almost went dark for months if our power had frozen. How do you see that transitioning happening though? When investor, when CEOs and management make decisions to maximize ROI on ESG investments, what sorts of changes will they actually be making besides, you know, healthier fuel and maybe different machinery?
Well, I think responsibly sourced gas will soon become responsibly sourced aviation fuel. I think relatively soon, within 24 months, you as a corporate executive wouldn't be caught dead getting on your corporate jet if there was a chance you could reduce the carbon footprint of your aviation fuel by 15%, just depending where you source the crude from. So that delta is right there today. And so it's a math, it's a change management. So let me give you, it's embarrassing, but true. My brother, Paul, won the Nobel Prize in Economics in 2018. And his co-winner is a guy named Bill Nordhaus, who is the one who wrote he's at Yale University. He's the one who wrote Cap and Trade. And so ultimately this planet is gonna insist transparency and on border adjustment fees, because I think a carbon tax is very hard. But already the EU is pretty much saying to the US, great, we'll buy 20, 30 years of your LNG to get off Russian gas, but we're going to measure your carbon footprint before it comes into EU, and then we're going to charge you according to your carbon loading. That's the measurement economy. And you know, it was actually in Stockholm where my brother Paul and William Nordhaus basically told me that the enemy of the truth isn't lies, it's just disinformation. And right now we're a massive amount of different disinformation about can we or can we not solve climate change. Hell yes, we can solve climate change in about 15 years of hard work. Right now there's an enormous amount of disinformation, some of it purposeful, some of it not purposeful, just trying to confuse people. This isn't solvable. It's not easy because it's a huge $3 trillion refurbishment of our economy. But there's disinformation on the left that you have to do 100% electrification and everything's going to have a battery and everything's going to base electrical. That, in my opinion, is not disinformation. It's just not based on math and science. There's obviously people on the right who still claim that climate change is not man-made. So those ecosystems of disinformation are holding back the radical middle who just wants to solve the goddamn problem. And I'm just one of the leaders teaching them, this isn't complicated, it's blocking and tackling, it's meat and potatoes, it's a math problem. We're gonna measure everything and then we're gonna hold people accountable in measurement. You measure what matters, what Peter Drucker said, it's what John Doerr has preached his whole life. Once you start measuring stuff, because the truth is, if you don't measure things, it's like trying to lose weight without a scale. You can wake up every morning and say, wow, my diet's going great. I feel so much better. But until you get on a scale, it doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, how do you prevent greenwashing?
You measure things. You measure things with third parties who have no financial interest in the outcome. And interestingly enough, the more you measure things, the more you don't want high stakes penalties, because there are high stakes penalties, people will just cheat. If you just measure things and force things to be transparent, you watch what happens. People will still start self-correcting. So one of the tricks here is to measure everything, but don't, you know, every time Elizabeth Warren starts talking about windfall profit tax, I want to pull my hair out, because it's exactly the way the left has held us back. We need to just get down in the radical middle. We need to measure everything. And trust me, those people in Houston love their grandchildren too. And once they start to measure things, they're gonna get on the right side of history. It's what I do every day.
Just to clarify there, so you put a timeline down of about 15 years as the quickest we can solve climate, not the quickest, but as a reasonable timeline for solving climate change. What do you think would happen in that time, just before we wrap up here?
no, I think we're going to do things like we've been stupid, like we shut down nuclear. What are you telling me? It's the best form of energy that we should be doing more of. We're going to do responsible use gas. We're going to do carbon sequestration. We're going to do some direct air capture. Yeah, we'll see that. But if we attach it to enough nuclear plants, enough wind, we probably can do DAC too. We're going to move to hydrogen. And we're going to just stop bullshitting each other. We're going to move to the measurement economy, and we're going to make this depoliticized. It's going to be just like safety. Like back in the day, I remember I didn't used to when I was about 3 years old. I wasn't in a seatbelt. I mean, I know there are certain people in the country who just think seatbelts are stupid, but the data is so clear that when you're in an accident and you're in a seatbelt, you live. And when you're not, you die. And so at some point, common sense just takes over. And at some point, we're going to do this. The challenge is there are 2 billion people in energy poverty today. And what we have to really think through is how do you make sure that the Africa and a lot of parts, India and other parts of the world, are able to become more energy abundant while decarbonizing. That's actually the biggest thing. And the most important thing we're going to do is we're going to get off coal. We're going to stop the methane leaks from natural gas. We're going to decarbonize both the pipes and the wires. The 100% electrification people are going to have to start bargaining that these pipes aren't going to go away. We're just going to put more hydrogen in these pipes because hydrogen is a great dense energy that we can store. And so the answer is we're going to cut the bullshit for both the left and the right. And finally, the radicals, those radicals in the middle, like me, are going to win.
Makes perfect sense. And I'm sure, you know, y'all can attest to this too, but on campus, there's a lot of people who wholeheartedly endorse that same opinion. And it's more about how can we convince the people with the money to make the change than knowing that the change is correct.
Remember what I taught you. The enemy of the truth isn't lies. It's just disinformation. So speak the truth and cut through. Do what you're doing with your podcast. Speak the truth and live by the truth. And also have humility that your vision of the truth is different than someone else's. But don't end up intentionally disinformation. If you provide disinformation because your vision of the truth isn't worthy of yourself, then you are the problem. If your vision of the truth is just wrong because your vision isn't clear, that's different than knowingly creating disinformation. Half of those people who are doing disinformation are doing it because they want to make a buck.
Well, mankind isn't perfect, are we? The final question that we ask all of our guests, and this doesn't have to be anything related to what we've talked about. It could be that you love pineapple on pizza. It doesn't really matter. But what's your hottest take or most controversial opinion?
Yeah, the hottest conflict in my life is between hikers, horseback riders, and me as a mountain biker, because I love to go really fast down the hill. And I know when I come around a curve too fast and there's a horse rider, I know I upset that person, but I love going fast. And so it's a perfect analogy in life. We need more trails, and I need to understand that my freedom to go fast on that trail can affect somebody who's walking. And so I need to both have my feng shui, my joy, my ability to go ripping down that trail, but I need to have respect that other people use that trail differently. And so it goes back to that weird thing that I talked about as an entrepreneur, that really important self-confidence and humility and how to hold those two things together at one time, because I do have a right to use that trail, but my right is not unlimited. And I need to walk carefully on this planet because other people see the world differently than I do. But at the end of the day, I just hold myself accountable to live my vision of the truth.
And that's the bottom line. Thank you so much for listening. If you like this podcast, please be sure to find us online at harvardventures.org. If you're a company or individual interested in working with us, email us at hello@harvardventures.org and follow us on Instagram @Harvard_Ventures. Tune in soon for another episode of The Bottom Line.